Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. PG Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Postgres, aspects of which are owned by the Postgres Global Development Group and the Regents of the University of California. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under, of the owning organizations, or the organizations that guests are part of. Introducing Show 6 with guest James Blackwell Sewell. Welcome. Our guest today is James Blackwell Sewell. James loves Postgres, Rust, and Kubernetes in that order. He spends his time chasing his children around New Zealand, working on making search transactional at ParadeDB, and talking about PGRX, a Rust-based framework for writing Postgres extensions. So welcome, James.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what I'll get you to do first up, just tell us what you do at ParadeDB.
So I've been working with Postgres, I suppose, since about the millennium. For a long time, I worked in Australia working for a consulting company. Then about 3 years ago, I decided to do something different and went to work for Timescale, which is now called Tiger Data, which is a New York-based startup that's making time series data possible in Postgres. I did that for 3 years, working, sort of running their developer advocacy team in marketing. And now I've just, in the last 3 weeks, moved across to a new company, ParadeDB, which is doing the same thing for full-text search in Postgres. So they're aiming to make Postgres as good as Elasticsearch for full-text search.
Yeah.
And in fact, better in a lot of ways, because you get all the benefits you get from Postgres as well as the benefits you get from Elastic.
Yeah. And so, look, what we plan to talk about today is Rust, actually. And so for many of the people listening, Rust will be brand new. I can only share very brief experience I've had of playing around with it myself. I've ended up with a bit of a love-hate relationship with it in trying it out, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. So why does Rust matter at all?
So I think the official tagline for Rust has now been changed to a language empowering anyone to build reliable and efficient software, which is a bit high level. Rust is a systems language similar to C, but it's a modern language. So in that way, it's more similar to C++ or something like that. So it's very good at writing low-level code that's going to run really fast without any abstractions. It doesn't have a garbage collector like Go. It doesn't have a JVM like Java.
Briefly mention that, I suppose, for those that are not familiar with that. So most of those sort of languages, when you allocate things, it's very hard to work out when to deallocate something. Yeah. And so many of those languages just have a thing that runs around and periodically looks to see anything that can't be reached and then just removes it. And so that's sort of collection, sort of. So it's a language that doesn't do that.
Yeah, it doesn't do that. So there's three approaches. So there's the way that C does it, where you manage it in your head. There's the way that a garbage collector does it, where it just keeps a list of allocations. And then when the allocations gets to zero, it knows that nothing has got that and it will just come around and reap it. And Rust is another one. So Rust will look at your program and prove that it's correct at the time you compile it. So it's compile time checking. So it's got this thing called the borrow checker, and there's a bunch of rules that say stuff like, if I have this variable in this scope, I can't use it outside of the scope. So basically, when people say they find Rust hard to use or hard to learn, what they normally mean is they have to appease this thing called the borrow checker. So you'll run compile your code, and it will come back and say, hey, this code's not valid. If you were to compile this, if I was to let you compile it, it would be undefined. What would happen? In C, it would just let you, and then it would seg fault at runtime. So it's sort of I like to think of it as the best of both worlds. Some people like to think of it as just another step to make it harder. And that line probably depends on whether that person grew up with C or they didn't grow up with C. I very much didn't grow up with C. I don't have that rigor. So I think Rust is an amazing language because it lets me do things that I would never have been able to do in Python.
Yeah.
In a systems language, it's like super fast and I don't need to worry about did I free that bit of memory already? Am I going to get a segmentation fault?
It was always a challenge with C. I must have been, I did a lot of C work in the 80s. Actually, I was teaching a systems programming course at a university where I had people writing things like shells and stuff like that. It was interesting for low-level work, but yes, it was very easy to do things that would cause it to blow up.
Yeah, and the burden of care is on the programmer, even if the programmer wrote it 5 years ago and is nowhere near the code anymore. Mm-hmm. Like if their mental model was wrong, then it's possible to get a segmentation fault at some time in the future. And the place where you don't want that is when it's running inside a database, because it will pull down your whole database. Well,
any low-level system services or things like that, it, you just don't want it. Yep.
Yeah. So PGRX is kind of like a union between Rust and Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
It showed up in about 2020. It was a sort of side project with this guy called Eric who made a thing called ZomboDB, which, funnily enough, was a link between Postgres and Elasticsearch. He now works at GraDB with me. The idea is to be able to very quickly create Postgres extensions before, if you want to create a Postgres extension, or at least a low-level Postgres extension, you'd have to write the code in C. Postgres has like a very specific C coding style. So not only do you have to learn C, you have to learn how the Postgres project works. Then you have to go and get your extension and compile it and put together with the SQL fragments and load it into Postgres. And hopefully it runs, hopefully it doesn't crash Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
PGRX is kind of like what if we were to make a safe way to write extensions and we were to do it in a fully managed sort of way?
Yeah. So it works. It feels like managed code from that point of view.
Yeah, it feels like managed code, and it will stop you from doing things that you shouldn't be doing. a lot of people who are users, their main thing, well, they usually love two things about it. They love the fact that it comes, Rust is very good at helping you run stuff. So it's got a thing called Cargo, and Cargo can run your code for you.
Yeah, so Cargo's like a package manager.
It's more than a package manager, but it allows you to package your code and compile your code and build your code and run your code and test your code. So
much more than that. Okay.
Yeah.
And the things that move around are called crates.
Yes. The packages are called crates and they're available on crates.io. So when you're using Cargo with PGRX, you can actually just say Cargo PGRX new and it will create you a new scaffolding for an extension.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can do Cargo PGRX run and it will actually inject that extension into a running Postgres and dump you into a shell and you can use it. You can be up and going without having Postgres or Rust installed on your system in 5 minutes.
Yeah. That's sort of interesting. It's actually the thing that fascinates me is the learning curve and the spin-up time. Actually, it's interesting you mentioned before that you had more of a Python background rather than a C background or something like that. It's just interesting. I've noticed with teams inside Microsoft, like if you look at the TypeScript team, they were recently making a decision about do we use Rust or do we use Go? And it was a weird decision where they decided it would have been better in Rust, but they opted for Go because they thought the getting it out the door was going to be quicker with the existing team, which is interesting.
I mean, that is definitely a big thing. I think, I mean, this is my own bias creeping in, but Go is a language that is written for the most junior developer on the team to be able to get up to speed as fast as possible. So it's anybody can write and read great Go code, but the code that they write and read might not necessarily be ultra high performance.
Yeah, it's interesting though. We're sort of suggesting that newer members on the teams adopted Rust much faster.
Yeah, there was a Rust conference in Wellington a couple of weeks ago, which was actually the first one. It's called Rust Forge. It had like 160 people. And one of the things we discussed was, do people who come to Rust find it hard because of their prior knowledge of programming languages, yep, or do they find it hard in general? And I think the consensus was that younger people, so much younger people who haven't had an introduction to programming, are much more likely to pick Rust up quickly because they're not trying to compare mm-hmm. it to the way they've done things in the past. They just...
Yeah.
And in that case, it's actually an amazing learning and teaching language because the compiler will very specifically tell you what you're doing wrong. And it will very specifically tell you how to fix it. Then you just have to go and do that.
Yeah, I suppose that's one of the beauties of it, is that it's, I suppose, essentially turning things that would have been runtime errors into compile time errors.
Yeah.
And there's a certain beauty to that. I must admit, I'm kind of a fan of things that are very type safe and strict and things like that. It's one of the things that I've often sort of wished for in languages like SQL, actually, ironically, is I've sort of grown up in a thing where I would love it to be more type safe, to be more strict in various bits of syntax. And there's also things I've always wanted to see in there that would help go further down that path. Like, for example, if you had a stored procedure, I'd love to have it where the metadata for it was more like a contract. And so on. Like, I mean, I shouldn't need to read the code of a stored procedure, for example, to work out what exceptions it might throw or things like that. And so even having sort of like Java-style exception handling, yeah, I mean, there's just lots and lots of things I'd love to see different. But it's interesting that so many of those concepts, all these sort of things, don't tend to exist in a language like SQL. And yeah, I've often wished for a sort of an option strict type thing or something. Yeah.
SQL's a super interesting language in terms of errors because it's almost like it doesn't, the errors just show up as like console warnings or like go into your error log a lot of the time. There's not really, you can catch them, but it's like living in the dark ages. One of the things that Rust is actually incredibly good at is error handling. So
yeah,
every single thing that can possibly fail, I have to acknowledge that thing can fail. So exactly.
And so there's the sort of, what's it called? Option enum thing or something with, you can't just let something happen. You've got to sort of say, I understand this might happen.
Yeah. And that's one of the things when I look back at my Python code that I was writing sort of 6 years ago, I now just all of a sudden look at it and think, gosh, there's a lot of things that I'm leaving to chance here on the off chance that I'll go wrong. Even with Go, you end up with Go code where it's everything returns an error code, but then you're just checking for this, did something go wrong every second? Did something go wrong?
Yes, I've worked with languages like that in the past, and that's very painful.
Yeah, it is very painful. Rust, I think, does a very good job of that. But obviously, there's the added burden is, again, added complexity. So it's something we find it quite hard to read or very verbose, I think, is a criticism I see sometimes. I would much rather have verbosity, sacrifice some verbosity. So it's be very verbose and have correctness.
Yes. Yeah, look, that's a really interesting thing because it's just one of the things that I've sort of pondered on. I've been in the industry a long time and we seem to have been moving more and more to, I don't know, less and less precise code, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, it's like standard error handling nowadays seems to be, oops, something went wrong. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't know how we as an industry ever got to the point that we decided that that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
The worst thing is that at the point something went wrong, somebody knows something about what went wrong.
Yeah, well, the runtime knows what's gone wrong because
that's right.
But it's just not exposed.
No.
If you think like that, then Rust is a great language, I think. You would rather be very specific about the error cases, then it's great for stuff like that.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com.
Which I suppose does make it slightly less, perhaps, performant for prototyping. Like if you're just trying to get something out the door in 5 minutes, Java might be faster. Although I think I'm finally over the hump now. In the last year or so, I can actually write Rust faster than I can write anything else.
It's interesting. It's I saw a few people who've really jumped in pretty well, even I suppose from the Postgres side of things. The Neon founder, Haki, he was sort of saying that pretty much all their storage code now is written in Rust as well. So, yeah, it was just interesting to see that sort of movement across in that sort of area.
That's actually a really interesting thing. If you look at the companies that use Rust or PGRX or a bit of both, you sort of got Neon, you've got Crunchy. So obviously that's Databricks and Snowflake now because they've both been acquired.
There's what sections of Snowflake at this stage, is it?
So Snowflake acquired Crunchy. So Crunchy are now running the Postgres part of Snowflake, or they're using Crunchy's technology. So they've sucked in the Rust code that Crunchy have, which I think was to do with reading and writing from Parquet format and Iceberg. That's what they use it for. It
probably would have been, yeah.
There's Timescale, Tiger Data, who are a very large Postgres startup, or ParadeDB. There was another one, Tembo. Pretty much every modern Postgres startup that comes out of Silicon Valley or New York these days is using Rust or PGRX in some way.
Yeah. Oh, look, even bigger ones. I saw Dropbox rewrote. You look at that and go, it's the volume of things they deal with there pretty high. Yeah.
Oh, the hyperscalers as well. Amazon, Google, Microsoft, all very to Rust code.
What sort of things, apart from safety and type safety, what sort of things do you think it will really work well with in terms of the database? Is it things that are predominantly computationally intensive? Is that...
So it's type safety, it's memory safety. That's probably the bigger one than type safety. I don't think things need to be computationally expensive to be written in Rust. I suppose the hurdle you have to get over is, should I just write this in PLPG SQL inside the database, or should I write it inside the database, or do I want to compile this externally and then inject it into the database? For a really simple function, you might not do that. As soon as you start talking about aggregates or anything like that, though, it's potentially worth it.
Yeah. I suppose one of the concerns I always have, as soon as you start mixing languages, of course, when we're talking about type safety and being strict and so on, what about the, I presume, equivalence or even potentially mismatch between data typing in Rust and with Postgres?
Yeah, I mean, we're quite lucky in Postgres that it has a fairly limited set of types, like SQL isn't all-encompassing. People can make their own types. In fact, you can make your own types in Rust that get ported across the SQL. But generally speaking, there's not that much of a surface area to define the mappings for. And at the end of the day, as far as Postgres is concerned, Rust is just C code running. It doesn't actually know about Rust. Rust compiles down to a dynamic object in the same way that C does. It uses the C FFI interface. Postgres just sees C code.
From that point of view, I think I was thinking about it more the other way around. It's like every time I take data from some typing system and go to another typing system, and then I come back to the original typing system, it always sort of feels like I've got the potential for something to go wrong there. It's it was sort of interesting. You mentioned Parquet files, or like Delta Parquet files and things like that a little while ago, because one of the concerns I have with that style of file being used with the databases is, again, invariably I've got a loss of precision or accuracy or typing or something like that as soon as I go out to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that's kind of when there's two processing engines, though. Like, I know that Parquet is a storage format, but like it's got its own spec. With Rust, we're just like, if something's an integer in C, we can use the same precision in Rust. It gets a little bit more gnarly. Like, if you're using PostGIS and you had a geospatial type, that geospatial type, when you ended up using it in Rust, has to be converted across. It would probably be converted to text today. There could be a few more inconsistencies there. So I suppose if you're dealing
with... The ones I was sort of wondering about more specific, spatial types and things like that are certainly one. But the ones where I usually come unstuck are more things like in Delta Parquet, there's a decimal type, but it's a float. Basically, it's not an actual decimal type. And so you sort of wonder when you hop between the languages, you know, again, it's the sort of, do I have something that started as a precise decimal or numeric value, and then it ends up not being one, you know, when it hits the other side?
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely seen a lot of that before, loss of precision. But, I mean, yeah, it's not something that PGRX needs to worry about, because it's using the same physical, because there's a mapping from SQL to C, we can just use the same mapping to go from SQL to C. That's the same underlying type.
Yeah, as I said, it often sort of worries me, but even bigger programs and things and stuff, it's weird they get that wrong. I mean, I do a lot of work, I have clients using, say, Power BI all the time, and the weird thing there is they have a decimal data type, but it's actually a float. And so, you know, I have customers who have the, why can't this thing add up numbers properly, you know, discussion, you know, because of rounding issues and things like that. And you just go, yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of how it works, yeah. And the thing is, it's not a problem for currency type values, because they have a data type which is precise for that. But the problem is, I've been doing work with like timber mills and people and so on, and you know, you don't, the exact decimal numbers are not always currency. So there's lots of things where they might not be. Yeah, I think that's the thing that always worries me, is just the interface to and from other languages, is you've just got that barrier where things could potentially be problematic.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you see that all the time when you import and export stuff between databases. Stuff shifts slightly. But usually that's to do with real numbers, I think. There's not really...
That sort of thing. Yeah, indeed. And so let's, I suppose there's two questions. How do people get started with Rust? What's your advice there? And how do they get started with PGRX?
So I would actually suggest that they get started with both at the same time, maybe. So if you were to go to the PGRX GitHub repo, it's got instructions, I think, for installing Rust and then installing PGRX and then sort of doing a hello world. If you want to sort of jump headfirst into Rust, then if you go to the rust.org webpage, there's a really good introduction to Rust course there. There's a number of really good books in Rust. There's actually a sort of one that's put out by the Rust core team, which we'll
step there was through. One called the Rust Book or something like that, I remember.
Yeah, that's the...
Yeah.
That's
the
There's another one, which I actually happen to have on my desk here. You can't run video. It's called Rust in Action by Tim McNamara, who actually lives in Wellington, New Zealand. It's a really good book as well. If you're going from 0 to 100, that's a great one.
Yeah. Rust has a lot of great PGRX, is it mostly just the Git repo, or are there any other online resources?
There aren't actually many online resources. The documentation is very good. So if you go follow through the documentation in the GitHub repo, there's like an examples directory, which has, I think, 10 or 20 different examples of, like, if you want to write a function in Postgres or if you want to write an aggregate in Postgres.
Oh, look, I did read through that, and I must have, I thought it was actually very clearly written, actually, the documentation. Yeah.
I think one of the things that we as a project need to get better at is our documentation. So I think it's very clear what's there, but there perhaps could be a bit more describing how the whole system hangs together.
It's interesting that I see two different things. You know, it used to be people worried more about the documentation and the clarity and the examples and things like that. And I often run into applications and languages and things nowadays where they've gone for completeness, but a lot of it is like machine-generated nonsense. And you know, one of the first things for me is that something that's meant to be help is meant to be helpful. I always think that's actually far more important than the completeness. And I don't know, that's an interesting. It's interesting from the SQL Server days. I remember discussing with one of the guys who was heading up the team at Microsoft, and he was talking about the documentation, and he said that they worked out that something like 70% of the pages no one ever's read. And so then they're trying to work out, like, do you put the effort into the 30% of pages people actually read? But would people freak out if there is no documentation for the pages that nobody reads? That's a tough call. You
know? Yeah. I could talk for a whole nother episode about documentation. So for like a open source project or for like a VC company running on open source, it's, the documentation is really the way that most developers find and learn and interact with your product. Like, you get more people who sort of learn about you via docs than you do via your website or anything else, really.
Yes.
And it's really interesting because there's like different types of documentation. It's not, people often lump it into one thing, but there's like a getting started guide, and there's like tutorials, there's like the API surface, and they all need to talk in like slightly different ways, and they all need to be there. I think people 100% do freak out if there's a something that they can do in your product that's not defined in the
API. It's not defined. Yeah, because the converse side of that, I always think, is that, you know, I look at things like objects, and they've got methods that are just not documented and so on, and I think, how long did it take to write the method, and what, they didn't have time to write any documentation about what it does? Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. There is actually another thing that Rust does very well. So I don't really know why this is. I think it's partly just the Rust community is into documentation, and it's partly that you can write very good inline documentation, and that'll be, you can expose that via Cargo. But Rust tends to have really good documentation, so everything will generally be documented when you look at a crate on crate style.
The PGRX stuff and the things that I was reading, I actually found the clarity of the language and stuff actually quite good, and so, because of course that's a different skill set entirely, is making something readable for I think of end users as developers in this case. Yeah.
100%. Technical writers are often much misaligned profession, but like they are 100% needed, or at least someone who's got that skill set. They need to call themselves a technical writer. Because it's very much not the writing that would go on your website. It needs to be, have that real line between teaching someone something, but teach them in such a way they're not going to turn off. It can't be too technical.
Yeah. It's interesting to know how you join those. It's one of the things Microsoft's done with their doco is they used to have a doc.microsoft.com site that was documentation, and then they had a learn site, which was the, you know, go and learn stuff, but they've moved it all in together to learn, and I'm not sure I love that, because I search for something now, and sometimes I actually want documentation. At other times, I'm happy to have something that's more tutorial or whatever. But when I'm searching, it's often got very different needs for those two things. And I understand the logic maybe why they want to put them together, but I'm not sure about that at all, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a constant struggle for people who are running documentation products or the documentation product inside a product org. At Timescale, we had a docs side and then we had a learn section. And
yeah,
the line kind of got blurred. I think that's probably what happened with Microsoft.
Yeah.
Sometimes those learn sections are also, they're just as much about SEO as they mm-hmm. are about documentation. So you're trying to write articles that you think you'll rank for to get traffic, which is like getting away from what developers are looking for sometimes.
Yeah. Hey, so listen, the final thing I wanted to talk about today, though, is the upcoming conference. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the conference is called Postgres Down Under, which is the same as the name of this podcast, which is
Well, we're PG Down Under, but yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is the fifth year that it's run. There's been a hiatus for, I think, 3 years. So it's before COVID, it kind of tailed off and then we never really started again. It's on October 17th in Sydney, I think, at the
next month.
Yeah, next month. If you search for PG Down Under or PGDU, we've got a website. Ticket sales are open. All of the talks have been finalized at this stage. It's 1 day.
Any particular session you're looking forward to? Or?
I suppose it depends what kind of thing you're after. There's a guy, Thomas Munro, who's a core contributor. He's talking about, I think, half a dozen exciting new features in the last three versions of Postgres. So that'd be a good introduction to where the Postgres project's going at the moment.
Yep.
There's some very like technology-specific ones. So I think there's someone talking about how GitLab's database load balancer works. There's people, lots of people talking about logical replication, how logical replication is getting better in Postgres. I think there's someone talking about job schedulers. There's people talking about how Postgres high availability works when you're running in the cloud.
Yeah.
It's quite a wide range of topics. So I think generally speaking, they're split up into sort of operations and administration. There's a bunch of people talking about Postgres development. And then a bunch of people talking, I suppose, about essentials or more broad Postgres topics.
Excellent. So we'll get people a look.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be good. We're hoping to have about 100 people. Amount we got last time. Yeah, and it should be good. It'll be rolling on from this year. So this is hopefully the first year that we're back, and then we'll
back and running. Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Hey, listen,
it alternates between Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, listen. So thank you so very much for your time today, James.
That's okay. It's been great to talk.
Awesome.